In the last week, hundreds of asylum seekers have been rescued from sinking boats on the Mediterranean. At least two women drowned and many others, including children, are missing and presumed drowned. A Médecins Sans Frontières boat was involved in the rescue effort for the people on one of the vessels, a sinking rubber dinghy. Lauren King was on the boat of the rescue effort and was among those who administered CPR, and she joins me on the phone from the MSF boat Aquarius. Lauren, thank you for your time. You are the communications manager from MSF, but you were on the boat when the rescue swung into action. Tell me what happened.
We had on the 27th of January, we had quite a devastating day. It was a chaotic scene. Our rescue boats were launched into the water as we approached a rubber boat in distress. Already when we approached, there were multiple people in the water, and we've been told by the rescue people that they had been in the water for some time. The entire left side of their boat was completely deflated, and just I was on board the Aquarius, not on our small rescue ship, but on board one by one, lifeless, unconscious and not breathing women and children were brought up to the ship. We have four medical team members on board the ship with MSF, and we were completely overwhelmed. From the very beginning, because we had nine people unconscious and not breathing, and that included six children, some as young as 1 year old and going up to 7 year olds. I personally worked on a 4 year old with supporting our medics, so I did the CPR compressions, and this 4 year old had effectively drowned, and we were working on him for up to 35 minutes before we really got him breathing again. Once we had all the people breathing, we actually revived seven of them. Unfortunately, two women we weren't able to successfully revive, and sadly they died. Another woman that we did revive later died when she was medically evacuated.
So you were actually involved in this resuscitation. What was that like for you? Because you are the communications officer, I imagine. Do you do much of this kind of frontline work?
It's a very unique project. Even being the communications manager, you're very much hands-on. So during a usual rescue, I would be doing CPR. Thankfully, it's not a usual occurrence. I would be registering people as they arrive. I'd be helping them get changed out of their wet clothes, handing out the kits. But this one was quite unusual. We do train for it, so every single time we go out to sea, everybody is trained in basic life support. I've never had to use it actually until now, so thankfully the training actually just really kicks in straight away, and we all know exactly what to do to support the medics. We know how to administer the chest compressions. I think in that moment it's quite a surreal feeling, but really the adrenaline just goes and you just kick into that mode of training and just do what you need to do.
So you say the adrenaline kicks in, you know, you've been trained and you clearly rose to this very difficult occasion. But as you were telling me, you're working on a four-year-old. I mean, it's obviously a very traumatic experience. Can you describe to me the broader scene mm-hmm. there? I mean, you're working on this child. This is a scene of, I imagine, chaos, distress, urgency. It must be a horrific scene. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was surrounding me, there were other children being worked on by our team members. In front of me, one of my colleagues was doing CPR chest compressions on a woman, and we were literally 1 meter apart. I do remember just looking at the child all the time and talking to him. I thought maybe it would help because we were getting some erratic kind of gasping sounds from him, and the medics were telling me that he was very close all the time, so I just kept talking to him as we were doing it. In between the chest compressions, I do 30 at a time, and then the nurse or the doctor would be doing the breaths. So I was just talking to him, trying to encourage him to come back. But around me, everybody was doing the same thing. There were CPR cases. There were other people who were breathing but with fluid in their lungs. We had lots of people with severe fuel burns who in that moment we don't prioritise. We have to go to the people that aren't breathing. So it's completely chaotic, but at the same time everybody's working and doing what they need to do.
How did you feel when you revived that little four-year-old? I mean, were his parents there? Did you have people around who were part of that moment? It must have been overwhelming to actually save a child's life like that.
I mean, it was complete elation and relief when he started breathing. After 35 minutes, I mean, I did think he would come back, but it's quite a long time to be doing it. But we never actually gave up, and there was no sign from the medic that we were giving up. So that was a good sign for me, and so I just took their lead with that. Unfortunately, his mother wasn't on the scene. We didn't find her until much later, but there was an auntie who was on board. So she came in after we had revived him. She was able to identify him, and he was hooked up to oxygen at that stage, wrapped up in emergency blankets, covered in our blankets as well, with hot water bottles trying to warm him up. His vital signs at this stage weren't very good. So when she came in, she was obviously traumatized herself, very weak, very exhausted. She came into a scene. We actually had, you know, people who had died around as well. So it wasn't a nice scene for her to come into, but I sat with her and explained that he's breathing and that she needed to sit with him and just to talk to him because he was alive. And then I think it was about 30 minutes before everyone was medically evacuated. We evacuated all the six children we revived, along with three other women and some caretakers. Just about half an hour before that, the child that I had worked on woke up and opened his eyes and was sitting up in his auntie's arms, which I was really, really shocked at because I didn't realise he would recover so well and so quickly. He looked quite tired, obviously, and still, I don't think he was quite aware of what had happened, but he was sitting up and talking and having a cuddle, which was so nice to see.
Yeah. There were some tragic deaths that day, as you said, but many people were rescued. What do we know about what's happened to those people who have survived?
So the people that were rescued by us, we were always directed by the Maritime Rescue Coordination Centre in Rome, and they allowed us to disembark the rescue people we had to Augusta in Sicily. And I believe the rest of the people rescued that day also went back to Italy. A lot of them were done by Italian vessels as well as other NGOs. However, earlier in the day that we did our rescue, we witnessed an interception by a Libyan Coast Guard vessel. We were actually very close to a rubber boat. We'd been directed there by the MRCC Rome. We'd found the rubber boat and were within 100 metres of it. We could actually see the people's faces. We could hear their cries for help. But we were then told by the Libyan Coast Guard that they would be taking those people. And we were told to comply with that by MRCC Rome. And that's quite a hard scene to watch. And we know those people are taken back to Libya, which is not a safe place.
How did the MSF boat come to be in this area when the rescue happened? Was MSF notified that these boats were in distress?
Yeah, so we work with MRCC Rome, and each time there's a boat in distress, they will call us as well as other vessels in the area to let them know, and then we will wait for advice from them. So if we're quite far away, they'll either tell us to remain on standby in another area, or they tell us to go directly to the boat in distress. So every time we're doing a rescue, we're being directed by MRCC Rome, which is, you know, under Italy. So we're being told to go there. So we never go unless we're being told, or in some circumstances, we've also spotted a boat ourselves, and then we would ring the MRCC Rome and they would coordinate it and allow us to do the rescue.
And where are these boats coming from? Where are these people leaving?
We get various reports. So each time we do a rescue, we do try to talk to people after they've recovered to see where they've departed from. It's a range. We've heard from Tripoli, from Al Homs, from Suwara. So these are all places in Libya, and from Zabrata. So it depends what's happening inside Libya, but there are departures all along the coast. People tell us different things. A lot of people have escaped poverty or conflict or violence in their home countries. Some people are going to Libya to work and to get money to send home to their families. Others are trafficked there. Others are going deliberately there because they think they can get to Europe through Libya. So it's a range of stories that we hear. The one thing that everybody has in common is once they get to Libya, they're all exposed to extreme levels of violence, extortion, kidnapping, rape, this sort of thing. We hear stories from people on the ship of pretty horrific scenes inside Libya, and many tell us that it's either die in Libya or die trying to escape and die on the sea.
Sadly, drownings like this in this part of the world, they're not uncommon. It's been reported that something like, I think it's 3,000 asylum seekers drowned in an attempt to get to Italy just in the last year. Is there any sense that these drowning tragedies are decreasing? What can you tell me about their scale right now?
Last year, 2017, compared to 2016, while the numbers of people crossing did drop, the percentage of those that drowned increased. And already this year, I think in the first 3 days of 2018, we had many people drown. So for us, it doesn't look like they're decreasing. And what people actually are telling us now is because there's been an effort to contain people in Libya, people are taking more risks to get on these flimsy rubber boats. So we've had people tell us that they've taken the crossing 2 times, including people who were just in this latest shipwreck that we rescued. We've had people tell us up to 5 attempts to cross. So people are being pushed more and more to take the dangerous journey more times.
And what role and what policy approach does MSF have in terms of trying to help asylum seekers who get into trouble at sea in this part of the world?
Yeah, so for us on the Aquarius out in the Mediterranean Sea, our objective is just to save people in distress. We don't question whether they're going to get asylum, whether they are refugees, migrants or asylum seekers. We just see people in distress, and in that immediate need, we need to rescue them and treat their immediate medical needs. What happens to them after that, so long as we can take them to a port of safety, and then it's up to Italy or Europe to process them.
I've got to just leave on a personal note if I can. I mean, Lauren, the work that you're involved in is really difficult frontline work. What keeps you going?
Well, definitely moments like on Saturday when I was able to revive someone. I mean, that's not something I ever thought I would ever do. But also the moments when we get to talk to people that we rescued and you just get to hear individual stories and they all just want a chance at life. They just want to live. It's a pretty basic need and request. And for me, when I get to hear their stories and feel like I've at least helped some people and at least stopped them from drowning, then that's definitely something that keeps not just me, but I think our whole team going.
Lauren, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Lauren King from MSF there. This is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis. Up next, it's The Drawing Room.